So thanks, Neil. Yeah, I would like to first thank for you guys for the opportunity for me to have the chance to present my talk here, my recent research. So as Neil said, my name is Gibrando. Today I'm going to talk about weak gravitational lensing from galaxy surveys to gravitational waves. I know that maybe the title is a little bit misleading because I'm not going to talk about like the fundamentals of weak lensing. I'm more or less going to assume that weak lensing is there and we can extract information from it. And I'm going to showcase and present the methodology and pipelines that I have been developing for the past years to extract information from weak gravitational lensing using galaxy surveys. And also nowadays, gravitational waves as well. Okay. So this talk, I'll split it in half. I'm first going to address the topic of large scale structural cosmology and galaxy surveys and the applications to and technology and the methodologies that I have been developing. And then I'm going to change to gravitational waves a little bit abruptly. So, I apologize for this, but maybe it's the best way I could split this talk. So, a little bit of motivation and just a brief recap. In cosmology, we have nowadays the standard model of cosmology. It's basically described by these two plots. So, on the left-hand side, we have the total energy budget of the universe, dark matter, almost 27%, ordinary matter, so interacting with light matter, comprises of 5%. And dark energy of about 68%. So we still don't know the fundamental questions and aspects behind dark matter and dark energy in the universe. And on the right-hand side, we have a brief, just a schematic figure of what is the diagram and the history expansion of our universe. We start here with a Big Bang or something like it. Then we experience a very fast expansion, accelerated expansion of our universe. The period is inflation. Subsequently, we have a slow expansion phase with the radiation era and then matter domination. And at present epoch, we have the accelerated expansion of our universe. And within the standard model of cosmology, both dark energy and this accelerated expansion of our universe currently are given in terms of this lambda term here. This lambda is the cosmological constant, which is added to the Einstein field equations. And it can consistently describe for both of these quantities there, both of these phenomena, with surprisingly like ease and simplicity behind it. Okay. So this is more or less the part that I'm going to address in this. Current in this talk. But as we know, there are some issues behind this cosmological constant. They may not be issues, but there is an intrinsic motivation of looking beyond lambda CDM theories, so going beyond the lambda cosmological constant paradigm. We have that in the upcoming years, in 2024, we're going to have DESI releasing its first data. And then we have Euclid and then the Vera Rubin Observatory, year one. So mainly the main motivation, one of the cornerstones of the motivation for each of these stage four LSS surveys is precisely to address what is the true nature of the current accelerated expansion of our universe. So we need to have and to come up with ways of addressing this issue of looking into beyond lambda syndrome theories. Besides that, we have also some issues or problems or motivations as well, such as the cosmological constant problem. There is like orders of magnitude between the values that you can theoretically compute using quantum field theory and then the observable expectation value of an energy vacuum in the universe. They are very discrepant, the two values of it. So we have increasing cosmological tensions or mild tensions or so on. We have the H-naught tension, we have the amplitude, the sigma-8 tension or like just discrepancy, which is not that evident, but maybe it's also there. So these can also have hints of new physics that can be addressed within dark energy. We have stress, we have to precisely to make the most out of the data that is coming from these three surveys. We have to create stress tests of the concordance model. So we have to make the most out of this data and trying to really understand if Lambda is indeed correct. And in the end, it's something that I have focused on my PhD, which is to develop cosmological tests of gravity. So a GR is very well constrained on solar system scales and astrophysical environments, but there is a very lack of accuracy or prediction, or like it's not the constraining power is not that good when we go to large scales. So maybe an explanation of Lambda, so an explanation of the dark energy paradigm, can be a modification to Einstein's general relativity in the largest scales of our universe. Okay. So starting from this principle that we need to test the Lambda CDM theory, or even go beyond Lambda CDM theory, we have that we need to devise new tools that probe the universe in its highly non-linear regime, so smaller scales. But so far, the most used tools that can accommodate multiple variations and modifications to Lambda CDM, ranging from modified gravity theories to extremely model independent tests like binning of the growth of structure, binning of the expansion history. The only tools that we have at our disposal to do this, they are these Einstein-Boltzmann solvers. And they are only valid at the background level, of course, and also at linear scales. So basically, we don't have tools that are fast and accurate to actually be able to probe the universe in the smaller scales. And here I'm just showing a plot where I show the power spectrum nonlinearity dependence for Euclid survey. So this is the color bar is just the boost function, which is the ratio between the power spectrum, the nonlinear matter power spectrum, with respect to the linear one. Over here, I just cut at 25% deviation, but it actually goes even bigger when you go to very darker and darker green regions, okay? And we're expected to cover with Euclid a little bit below 0.5, like 0.2 or something like that, and then go a little bit above 2.5 in redshift. So the left axis is time. The bottom axis is the scales, okay? This is in real space, and then this is in normal space, like distances. And in the top axis, I have the corresponding values in angular scales. So we have the minimum multiple of Euclid will be something around 10, will be 10, I think. And the maximum one, the most optimistic scenario is 5,000. So this is more or less, this red region here is more or less where Euclid is going to be covering. These orange lines are just the cosmological horizon. This is the cosmological horizon. This is 10 times the cosmological horizon. And this is 100 times the cosmological horizon. So yeah, this is more or less the scenario that we have at stage four or less of surveys. And this is what we have to actually predict and give predictions to this, okay? So, but there are some intrinsic problems and difficulties of modeling nonlinear scales. So the most predictive way that we can extract information of these very small scales, there it is via non-perturbative schemes, such as n-body simulations. But it's known that these n-body simulations, they are very time-consuming and very expensive computationally-wise. And everything gets even worse for beyond Lambda CDM, especially if we're dealing with a theory that has some scale dependence in the growth of structure in the universe, such as modified gravity theories, okay? So our idea is basically we have to balance out. So in the beyond Lambda CDM community, the way I see, we have to balance out a trade-off between predictive power and cost. So we have to come up with ways and different methodologies and different alternatives to still get the most from the data without spoiling anything in the sense of biasing our results, okay? And in this talk, I'm going to focus precisely on one of these viable alternatives. That is what I have been working in the past few years. It's called the commoving Lagrangian approximation method, COLA for short. I'm going to mention this name a lot of the times, so I apologize for this in advance. And basically, COLA is in very short words, is just a combination, a smart combination between two things. We know that at large scales, the universe is very well described by perturbation theory. So Kolle combines LPT, so Lagrangian perturbation theory, to describe the larger scales of our universe. And when we go to small scales, it has a particle mesh algorithm to solve for this very mode coupling between particles. Okay, so this is more or less the idea of Kolle, and this is what's going to allow Kolle to have at least two orders of magnitude faster, to be two orders of magnitude faster than a full-on body, because we don't spend a lot of time solving for the larger scales of our universe, because we are already going to input in the particles' positions correctly the LPT deviations of it. So basically, in the end, we have fast realizations of the density field without having to run, for instance, a full-on body code. So this is just a panel that I like. It's very old already, from the original paper of Kolle by Tassev et al. So we have here just a region that I'm highlighting. With two LPT, we have some idea of what is going on here. There's something here. With Kolle and 10 time steps, we have an increased accuracy of this. And with Gadget 2000 times, we have even more resolution there. To the naked eye, these two may not be different, but they are in fact very different, especially in the to meet the requirements that we have for stage four LSS surveys. So basically, we know that Gadget is the true solution, and we know that Kolle is just an approximate solution to this true solution. So what we need to do is to build on Kolle and show where we can go with it. Okay. So also just to give an idea for those who are interested in these things. So Kolle is computationally less clock costly. So we have a reduction in wall clock to finish our simulations. This is a table that I extracted from this paper. We have here the wall clock time, a full-on body simulation that they ran with Gadget 2. This is a very this is a normal resolution for a simulation to extract and estimate the power spectrum. This is not so good to do other things, but for the matter power spectrum is decent, this resolution. And it took 150 hours to finish, while Kolle simulations with different setups, different time step, number of time steps, different redshifts, and so on, they finished all of them before, not this one, but almost around 1 hour or 2 hours or even less. So the claim that is two orders of magnitude faster is indeed what we have and expect. Okay. Feel free to ask questions, or I'm open to questions. So
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Could you explain a little bit more how Kolle does this numerical simulation? Because it's not doing what Gadget is doing, but it's doing something like an n-body simulation because it looks the same as that. So what is it that it's doing?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So I didn't expand on this, but basically, what Kolle does is that it splits the particle's position into something that we are going to describe with two LPT, plus something that we call that is the mode coupling. So the residual particle position that is going to be solved by the particle mesh code. So what we actually solve is not for the true position and the true momentum of the particle. So we solve for this extra piece of the particle position that is the mode coupling one. So this is going to be solved for the within the particle mesh scenario. So we'll have the we'll solve the usual Poisson equations of motion and so on, and then we just add at each time step the simulation the true LPT particles position that we already know. Does that make sense to you?
Okay, maybe a little bit. I guess what I'm kind of confused by is, yeah, the 12PT, you have 3 time steps. Kolle, you said 10 time steps. There's only 3 times more, but you get all the kind of looks like you get halos and like virialize the structure. I mean, can you get like virialize the structure in Kolle?
Yes, so Kolle, you can get virialized structure. It's not ideal for that because so we really lose resolution at small scales. So we are going to misestimate all of these virialized structure. But of course, this will always depend on the resolution of your simulation. This is a very crude way of thinking and presenting COLA because this is just time steps. But at the same time, we need to realize the size of the box, the number of particles, the force resolution. So to solve a particle mesh code, we need a given number of cell grids to use our FFT algorithms. So basically, I don't remember quite well what was their configurations for the COLA simulations, but I think I may be able to address this throughout the talk.
Okay, thank you.
Well, so to rephrase maybe the question on slightly, so if you ran Gadget for 10 time steps also, would it look similar to the COLA picture?
No, I don't think so because 10 time steps, nothing will get converged there. So I think that in the end, this is, if you think at large scales, everything is going to be very bad. Things are going to be like not even clustered in the sense of following like linear theory. So I don't think it's possible to run because Gadget is solving for particles position, so particles see each other. So in the sense they have orbits and so on. So I think that if you run for 10 time steps, it's going to be the this is going to be very weird. I don't think it's I never did this, but I can think about this.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Yes. So I think that if somebody stretches the eye, okay, I'm going to yeah, there are some mild dependence differences here that I'm going to show. So one of them is so basically what I was saying that it's something that's things that we already have on COLA and already have used and validated COLA with. So we have already some extensions to Lambda CDM in COLA. We have already validated, for instance, the implementation of massive neutrinos in COLA. Here I'm just showcasing. So this is basically the suppression factor between the nonlinear matter power spectra with the massive neutrinos with 0.15 electron volts. And this is with massless neutrinos only. So basically, the power spectrum is going to have a suppression factor due to these massive neutrinos. The solid lines are just the Euclid emulator 2, which I'm always going to claim as EE2. Okay. EE2 or Euclid emulator 2 is a state-of-the-art emulator. It was trained with very high resolution simulations. So in the sense, it's just a quicker way of getting a full one-body simulation and compare with our data. And we can see that the difference between the same predictions of Euclid emulator 2 and COLA, they agree up until k equals 3.14, below 2%. This is a very good test. This was a very cheap COLA simulation. I didn't go into the details, but this is something that was similar to what was done in the Euclid paper on massive neutrinos. Okay. And COLA does not introduce any biases when we introduce massive neutrinos on it. And at the same time, as I mentioned, my PhD was in modified gravity theories and very complicated theories with sometimes screening mechanisms, which are mechanisms that needs to shield an extra force that appears when we have a scalar field. And in this right-hand plot here, I'm just plotting one of these theories that we have, which is the cubic Galilean theory. And I'm comparing an approximate on a COLA simulation with the screening method that I devised in my PhD. And I'm comparing here and showing the agreement that we get between when we compare the ratio between a cubic Galilean matter power spectrum and a general relativity one. And we can see that COLA is in agreement, a very good agreement, below 1% until k equals 3. Okay. Again, these are specific theories. So, for instance, this is a very wild theory, but still the cosmological parameters are very mild. So, they're still within the vanilla Lambda CDM cosmological parameters. So, it's interesting that we have such a good agreement, but we always need to think how far can we go because this is the task and that we have at hand with stage four LSS surveys. And maybe over here, I start to presenting some things that get a little bit ugly. So, for instance, here I'm comparing a COLA simulation, which is the solid blue on the left-hand side, a particle mesh simulation, so just the n-body part, not adding Lagrangian particle displacements. So the particle mesh simulations here, they have a lot of more time steps than the COLA one. And they have two different force resolutions. This is a very important setting in the particle mesh simulations, which may address one of the questions that are appear so far. This is using three times the number of particles per dimension. So the number of cell grids is three times bigger, and the green one is four times bigger. And COLA, what we have been doing so far is an insane effort, a very exquisite effort to validate and benchmark COLA using either state-of-the-art emulators for Lambda CDM, but also full in-body simulations. So over here, we can see that the particle mesh does converge better to the true solution. This is still not what we want, but over here, we can just start to understand the difference between COLA simulations and a particle mesh simulation. And on the right-hand side is the comparison that we did and we needed to do to compare that our particle mesh solver inside the COLA version that we use is indeed matching well with what we have also when we compare it to another state-of-the-art emulator, which is the BACO emulator. It has a very high resolution simulations to be they were trained on. And we also compare with the solid line here called Arepo, which is a full in-body code. It's the successor of gadget simulations of the gadget code. And here we're just comparing two high and low mass resolutions of our particle mesh simulations. We can see that up until k equals 2, we are within 1% when we compare to a high resolution power spectrum that was given by BACO. And we follow very nicely and have until k equals 2 as well, and within 1% when we have a low mass resolution particle mesh simulation matching the same with Arepo. So these two in this comparison is what we were aiming for. We needed to benchmark our low resolution particle mesh simulations and our high resolutions as well. So this is our efforts to see and show that if we are going to use COLA for doing beyond Lambda CDM investigations, we need to provide alternatives that have been validated and benchmarked with truths outside of in the literature. Okay, you can also ask questions. There was another very bad thing here happening here, which is this scatter around the BAO scale. This is very bad. So the BAO scale should be something that we are very good in modeling, precisely because at higher redshift, it gets linear and linear. Nowadays, it's very mildly nonlinear. And this essentially comes because particle mesh simulations don't actually, as I was saying, they don't actually, they are not very good, as good as very high resolution ones. So if we trade the algorithm to solve our small scales, we will lose the cold efficiency, but we will gain a lot in precisely resolution and reducing this variance that we have here. These are mainly residuals that appear from the simulation. And then to extend COLA and use it to compute and emulate the boost function, we devised this strategy here, which is instead of emulating directly this quantity, nonlinear over linear, we in turn emulate this quantity, which is the boost of a case cosmology, which can be anything. In this case was like just a mild difference between the reference cosmology. So for instance, we have a reference cosmology in Euclid, then we just chose that reference cosmology and we varied a little bit. And then we call this new cosmology, the case cosmology. And it turns out when we multiply this reference boost that comes either from this emulator, or even if you want to create a new entirely new, it can also be computed using full in-body simulation. When we multiply it by this ratio of what we call nonlinear and linear response functions, we can remove much of the scatter. So this is a comparison at the level of the power spectrum, and we can see that it's not ideal. And this is a comparison at the level of the nonlinear response function. This is another validation that we needed to do. And why this scatter suddenly disappears? Because all of the inaccuracies of COLA simulations that are in the nonlinear metaphor spectrum of the of this case cosmology gets canceled out on this reference cosmology as well. So we can see that these were low resolution simulations, so they were good up until k equals one, but we can see that much of the scatter that we had here at a one cosmology, it mainly removed. Okay, so this was something that we needed to do to actually be able to move with our plan. But as I mentioned, so far I had just I'm just presenting for instance, ideal scenarios in which we choose fixed cosmologies and theories and just compare power spectra with power spectra. But to show that Kolo can be a true viable alternative, we need to go further. We need to construct a Kolo-based emulator, and we need to perform a full parameter estimation using some stage four LSS survey as a guideline. Okay. So for this, we just chose a mild extension of Lambda CDM, which is WCDM. So the equation of state is allowed to vary. This choice is motivated not because we don't have in the literature, because Euclid Emulator 2 and Baku, they already have WCDM cosmologies there. But we needed to choose this because we wanted to validate how much can we construct a new emulator using Kolo with having something that is already trustworthy in the literature. So that's why we chose WCDM cosmology, and I'm going to show some results that I think they are very interesting. We chose two different precisions for Kolo simulations, and we also chose the same parameter space as Euclid Emulator 2. These are just details that may not be that important, but it's just to mention that there is a these are light simulations and these are heavy simulations, just to get an idea of what we're going to do. So this is the only part that I mentioned, weak lensing, that I noticed later that the title may be misleading, because weak lensing, the only we're so this pipeline was we're trying to construct it for photometric probes. So one of the ingredients and one of the observables that we can that we actually have to measure and compute many times for instance LSST year one, it's the shear angular power spectrum, which is defined like this. We have this Q functions here, the lensing efficiencies. They are window functions weighted by distances. And here we have the nonlinear metaphor spectrum, which is precisely what I have been talking so far a lot. So this is exactly the cosmological observable that we are going to compute many times using this Kolo-based emulator that we created for this quantity here. Another very important thing that I should have highlighted more, maybe, it's that these are just survey specifications, because maybe in the audience somebody has knows a little bit more about this. So this is five tomographic pins, which comes. LSST has, so it has in source and lens galaxies. They are drawn from this Snell distribution with Z naught and alpha given by this, and these are more or less the priors that we have assigned for the each nuisance parameter, so systematical parameter that we're going to when we ran our MCMC chains. Okay, but basically this is the most important thing for me, which is that we have decided to choose three different masks, so three different scale cuts per bin, and we tested each of these three different masks. Because basically, so there is a limit to where we can model our theory. Okay, so the theoretical prediction from this metapore spectrum is not going to go from 0 to 100,000 or infinity. We know that there is a certain threshold in which we can trust it. And we chose three different masks, which can be implemented on LSST year one. They are called M2, M3, and M4 for each tomographic bin. Okay, and these essentially they just showcase the different maximum scales that we go or used for this power spectra computed from Kolo simulations. Okay. So M2 is the most aggressive one in the sense of allowing for more nonlinearities to enter the computation of the shear. for spectrum, and M4 is the loosest one, okay, the most conservative. So there's a difference. People can assign conservative in a different way, but I like to say that think aggressive is more non-linear, but maybe it's the opposite direction. So this is first our results for the emulator. So this is on the left-hand side. I'm comparing the boost between Cole and Euclid Emulator 2. A lot of spread, mainly because now we're varying a lot of cosmologies. Before, it was presenting just idealistic scenarios that show that Cole could reproduce until k equals 1 with 1%, 2%, things like that. But now the parameters, they can go very far away from the reference cosmology. So the reference cosmology sits at the center. And this hypercube now can go like to two, three times the distance that I showed that I was showing before. This
Sorry,
was already. Oh, sorry.
Guy, sorry, yeah, okay. Can I
Yeah,
ask,
sure.
so I missed, I think, what this emulator was.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, no worries. Maybe I wasn't exactly clear because I spent some time talking about something else. So the boost. So
No, sorry. I mean, like some of these plots, you're comparing these Cola sims to this Euclid emulator. I was just wondering, like, what is this Euclid emulator?
So this Euclid emulator is also the same thing as what we were comparing before for Cola. So the Euclid emulator 2 is just going to provide us this boost, which is the ratio between the nonlinear and the linear. So, and this is more or less like Halo fit. I don't know if you're aware or familiar with. So Euclid emulator 2 and Baku emulator, they are just fast and accurate predictions of this boost. So you get a linear matter power spectrum from an Einstein-Boltzmann solver. And then you multiply by this function B of K here. So this function B of K is generally, starts at unity at small scales because it's where the universe is linear. And then it grows exponentially because there's a very big difference between nonlinear matter power spectrum and linear. Okay.
Sure. In
So this boost
your
is basic.
presentation, right? So it seems as if you are presenting this, emulator as the truth.
Yes.
Okay, so if you believe
Yeah.
the emulator so
Yes.
strongly, and it's an emulator, and so it's fast, so then so what's the purpose then, for doing these approximate Cola simulations?
Yeah, so it's essentially to create new emulators for things that Euclid Emulator 2 or other emulators they don't cover. So basically, now I'm here. I need to assume that something is the truth, but we can vary the truth if you don't trust Euclid Emulator 2. Is that so? Cole is so flexible that we can just disregard it and create something new. So basically, if we had all the time in the world in a high performance computer, we could, in principle, run very high-end n-body simulations for the very for the plethora of beyond Lambda CDM theories. We don't. So maybe an idea that we are proposing is precisely to use Cola simulations that are very cheap to run, so we can build many emulators for different theories. And yeah, is this clear?
Yeah, maybe. Okay. But Jessie has her hand up. I'm gonna let her answer.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a related question. So from what you're presenting, it's my understanding that if you set up a COLA for a new cosmological model, you're going to want to validate it against an n-body simulation. And definitely correct me if I'm wrong on that. Can you give us a sense of like how many n-body simulations you would need to run to like validate a new implementation of COLA versus setting up an emulator based on that n-body simulation? I'm assuming that's where the savings is. Like,
Yeah,
does
so
it cost less to validate COLA than to set up a new emulator with an n-body?
yes. So what we need in the end, we don't need to create an emulator for something that is the truth already, because then if we had already the truth, if we have a lot of full n-body simulations, then there is no need to run Cola because that is the truth. So the idea here is basically that so since we have already validated Cola many times using full n-body simulations, if we wanted to go on and just create an emulator using Cola, we could. So for instance, for the emulator for the theories that I have described so far and others in the literature that I can point, we can already create emulators for them. But ideally, that's not what we want. We want to not rely on antibody simulations. So what I'm going to actually discuss a little bit towards the end is that we need to reduce the level of complexity in beyond lambda CDM models to increase the level of modeling and trustworthy, so we can be trustworthy in their predictions. So as long as we are not too crazy in the theory, we can trust COLA because, but of course, if we want to validate, it's just a matter of choosing like extrema of parameter range that you're interested in, and then you validate it. And then it would be cheap as well. So you'll just run one or two simulations. So yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, sure. So maybe so after these questions, maybe it was not that directly clear. So the basic quantity that we want to predict fastly is the metapole spectrum, and precisely the nonlinear metapole spectrum. And then we often rely on the use of this boost factor. And this is precisely what I'm showing here, that so something that is state of the art and the community takes it as a reference, and you have to use it, you have to assume that something's true. I'm comparing this COLA-based emulator using the Euclid emulator 2. And so even though we have an interesting scatter here that was not shown before, this is something that if we compare with another prediction for the nonlinear metapore spectra that we already have and already used, in, for instance, in DES or 3 and so on, which is this HM code prediction, this is not that unexpected. So Euclid Emulator 2 was built with more resolution, with increased resolution. But then again, it's just a matter of where you need to anchor your truth. So in this case, we anchored on the Euclid Emulator 2, but we can already do this with something else as well. So I'm going to present this by taking that Euclid Emulator 2 is at least a representative of full on-body simulations that it, in which it was calibrated for.
Okay. So can I ask which one is actually correct here, HM code or Euclidean Euclid Emulator?
So I would say, based on my experience on in-body simulations, I would say that Euclid Emulator 2 is the correct, because HM code is a fit. So HM code is something that is a fit, and it also uses very high-end simulations, but in the end, Euclid Emulator 2 beats this in the sense of having more realizations to train for. So if I remember correctly, it was almost 150 simulations. So I would say that here the truth would be Euclid Emulator 2. Okay.
Yeah, I mean emulators are also a fit of some sort, just a different way of doing a fit. So, but it's I guess it would be in the, it would be good to know actually, like if you actually have a look at an actual simulation, which one is better.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. If you go to the Euclid Emulator 2 paper, maybe there's some comparisons there, because you do in the end, have a test validation set, a test set. Mm-hmm. So after you train the emulator, and then there, if they could, they were very good and able to reproduce the simulation. So the same thing we had with COLA, like our agreement between the emulated boost and the true simulations, they were like below 0.1%. So they were very much in agreement. So yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, sure. So yeah. So after this, these were good questions, because it maybe explains a little bit better what I was doing. So yeah, once we have the simulator ready, and once we have trained it and tested it and validated it, we then did something that is also a consistency check, but in the sense of just doing parameter inference on something that we know that we can recover. So we know that we have trained our emulator for like a very specific point in the cosmology set, which is the Euclid emulator 2 reference. So we just train everything to at least there, our COLA-based emulator is going to be exactly the same thing as the Euclid emulator 2, okay? And here I'm presenting precisely this. So this is the corner plot with using this Euclidean emulator to reference for the data vector and an M2 mask. So we can see that this is the most aggressive mask, the one that contains more non-linearities. So, and we can see that it has recovered everything from Euclidean emulator 2. But the same is not true if you start just going around the data vector. So if you move the data vector far away from the reference cosmology, then this is what happens. This is basically the figure of bias. We go outside. So for some of these data vectors that we chose, such as this one, we do not recover some of the parameters that were the ones that we inputted. So for instance, here. So if we have a very non-aggressive, so the one that is not so non-linear mass, then we are able to reproduce the same thing as Euclidean emulator 2. But ideally, we don't want this. We want everything to be within one sigma. So this is more or less the thing that that I was telling about. And this is something that we need to deal with it and improve on the COLA and the simulation side of the pipeline. Okay. And one simple idea that we had to correct this is simply to increase the number of reference cosmologies, because the reference cosmology is the one that you train to be good. So if you have a very wild parameter set, so this one is very different and very far away from the reference cosmology, then is expected that the emulator or even the predictions are going to degrade. So we just did a simple scenario in which we increase the number of reference cosmologies in our training set. We go from 1 to 25. Now I'm not showing this ugly plot here where everything is very scattered and just lines. I'm just showing the histogram in which the number of times that our COLA simulations matched Euclidean emulator 2 at k equals 1. So basically, I'm just putting everything that is crossing k equals 1 here. Okay, and we can see that when we increase the number of references, this distribution gets peaked. It's peaked around zero. So it's more number of references here. And indeed, this is helps a lot, the figure of bias, and this helps a lot our emulation procedure, because all of these cases, so this is COLA default, COLA one reference, this is COLA one reference plus 25 references, so this one, and these were the high resolution simulations of COLA. So you can see that the high resolution simulations of COLA didn't improve anything, in the sense that the point that was outside the one sigma deviation stayed outside. And the only thing that really helped was to increase the number of references. So this is one of the proposed solutions that we have for this project that we are ongoing and we are expecting to finish pretty soon. So basically, this was basically a project in which we took everything that was from COLA in the literature, because COLA has some groups of people that are very interested on it, and we put it to test by doing actual parameter inference to see if we are meeting the requirements of stage 4 LSS surveys. So yeah, you can. Oh, there's someone. Let's see.
Hi, yeah, it's me again. I have a question. So I'm wondering, this is really interesting to see. I'm wondering if, so you're using the parameter bias as motivation for trying to improve, you know, simulations by running more simulations. Sort of as another way of looking at this, if say somebody who's doing an analysis has a certain like systematic error allowance of like how much bias and parameters they want to accept from one of many different, you know, modeling uncertainties. Given that kind of threshold, would you be able to give like a prescription for how to define, like, you know, some guidelines for how to pick scale cuts to account for, to make sure that bias from COLA inaccuracies is below a certain threshold?
No, yeah, that's a very good question, because this is what we're doing now. So actually, because we just finished this figure of bias thing. And so actually, we are not running more simulations. This 25 references here is just assuming in the point that we are creating an emulator from something that already exists. So the 25 references are already cheap because they already exist. So it's not extra work that we're adding. So basically, the only thing that we ran once, and it was like 1 year ago, was the Colo simulations, but now we didn't run anything else. So I wouldn't, so our idea is to, we were aiming for M2, but we're not going to tackle M2. We're aiming for M3. So the mask that is in between, the most aggressive and the most conservative. But we hope to improve to M2 very soon in a companion paper, like in a future paper, because this is where we're going to tackle for. So yeah, this is a very good question. So basically, what I decided to show here was just that we can create new emulators using Kohler, and I tried to do this, but yeah, but okay, yeah, that's a good question. Thanks. So yeah, so just to point some futuristic points that we need to cover, because it's more or less something that we already know, like a BAO scatter between. Assuming that we are using a Euclid emulator truth. So basically, we need to assume a truth. So this could be also not only be Euclid emulator truth, but it could be full n-body simulations. This can be whatever we want. We're just anchoring at somewhere. So we need to reduce the scatter in the BAO scale because precisely it's something that we already know how to do it. And this is doable. This is something that we can just run bigger boxes of simulations and then stitch the Matterport spectra. This is something that people have done in the past and did in also to train other emulators. So this is something doable. It's direct. And we also need to improve the high K behavior. So the high K behavior is a little bit shadier because we don't want to not. So since beyond lambda CDM models are hard for us to run full simulations with, it is really not ideal for us to change the Kohler prescription in small scales, because changing that will in the end introduce more time and complexity for our simulations. So we need to do something at the level of post-processing. So basically, we want to. This is an interesting approach which I have implemented in Kohler, which is the potential gradient descent method. We basically, at each time step of the simulation, we filter out the result. So we filter out the density field in a way that we can actually correct some of the incorrectness of particle mesh simulations. And then, for instance, this is a plot where we can see that even in the case of running a full particle mesh simulation, this PGD correction here makes it even better. So this is something that is already in the making, and it's an idea that we have that is very straightforward to move on with the project. So, and the, hopefully this will allow us to go to even more smaller scales. So actually, I want to ask Neil, because I finished the LSS part here. I don't think I have more time to go to the gravitational wave lensing part. So
Oh,
basically,
well, it's up to you. I mean, let's see. So we have maybe like 5, 10 minutes left. I mean, I don't know. It's up to you.
yeah. Well, okay. I can go over some interesting things there because I think that it's well, it's a new pro. So basically, this is the conclusions for large scale structure. They're pretty straightforward. So the computation of the pipeline for weak lensing is actually not composed only on the shear power spectrum. We have other components that we need to compute to perform what is called the 3x2 point analysis. We need to not only emulate the Matterport spectrum, we need to actually emulate the galaxy power spectrum. So galaxies are biased tracers, so we need to go beyond linear bias, which is what has been done so far. We need to add baryonic effects. This can be done differently by just using post-processing methods in the same way as other emulators have done in the past. We are interested in accommodating this into our pipeline as well. And so yeah, these are the conclusions that I can have and can make here. And since we have another 10 minutes, I'm going to discuss a little bit and show put some light into something that I think it's interesting nowadays. So as we know, gravitational waves are very interesting and very they're like this new window that opened to us. And similarly to light, gravitational waves, they are also lensed when they propagate through an object. And but contrary to light, some of this gravitational waves, they will not have very small wavelengths. They can have wavelengths that are typically of the size of the object that they're being lensed. So basically this schematic here, it's, I'm not going to discuss this, but I just wanted to give an idea of how gravitational wave lensing happens. These are two coalescing objects, a gravitational wave being emitted. In the strong lensing case, one of the waveforms arrives before than the other one. So basically these are images. So this one is an image. So actually these two are images. And then the difference and what we will have in the strong lensing case is that we will have the same waveform two times, one magnified and the other demagnified. And in the case, they will have a typical time delay that it will also depend on the geometry of our strong lensing scenario. So this is more or less how it happens. But what I'm going to talk is not the strong lensing kind. It's also, it's something that is related to gravitational waves having the same order of magnitude in their wavelength as the lensing object. So if we remember optics or like basic physics, there are like, if we have like this slit and double slit experiment, we have diffraction effects that are like wave optics effects. They're purely wave optics. And in this case, when they have the same order of magnitude of frequencies, we cannot use the geometric optics expansion. Optics is just for a very high frequency. So we need to solve the full and entirety Fresnel integral, which is the diffraction integral. So this is what happens. They are being the coalescence here. There's going to be a gravitational wave. Actually, this galaxy here is precisely this galaxy or halo or whatever is precisely this gap. And there's going to be a diffraction effect on top of this wavelength or waveform, okay? We're also dealing, this normally happens precisely when we have only one image, okay? It's a more frequent. So we're not going to be, I am not going to be interested in the case of having two images or checking time delays or magnification, because we can't even measure the magnification, but I'm interested in diffraction effects. And what is this? Basically, even in cosmology or in light, with light, we have the geometric optic limits. It's just the geometric optics limit of the high frequency, the stationary phase approximation of the amplification factor. So the amplification factor is just the ratio between lensed waveform and unlensed waveform. So basically lensed waveform is the unlensed one times something that depends on the frequency. And this is more or less the phase of this quantity. We have this oscillatory, very highly oscillatory phase over here, which is the geometric optics phase. This is precisely when it simplifies the integral that we need to solve to actually compute diffraction and wave optics effects. This is the first case that I showed, and precisely this is what happens. These are the waveforms, okay? They come here and they have a lot of the spiral phase, and then they merge, and then they stop. But in this case, we have the unlensed waveform, which is the black, and we have the magnified version of it, one of the images, and then we have the other image, which is demagnified. This is the strong lensing case, which is basically geometric optics case in a very high frequency regime. But the regime that I'm interested in is precisely B, orange, which we can see that it's on top of only on one image, we have these diffraction effects. So basically frequency dependent effects that are going to modulate the signal. Also, you can check that, for instance, the lens mass that can cause this kind of things is 3 × 10²² solar masses. But this is precisely what I want to address, because I have been working in the past few years on LISA sources. If you check here, for instance, the frequency is around one that is going to have this wave optics effects. So it's our order unit in frequency. If we do some algebraic manipulations, we can see that for two examples of gravitational wave detectors, we have the LIGO detector, which is the one that is active right now. It's a network called LVK, LIGO Virgo Kagre. Virgo is in Europe and Kagre is in Japan. Kagre is not active yet, but this is more or less what happens. So basically, this in this first sentence, we have the lensing, the lenses that we can present that can introduce wave optics effects in the gravitational waveform. They range from, they're basically stellar mass. So basically stars are the ones that can cause this kind of diffracting effects, diffraction effects in the gravitational waveform. While for LISA, since we are going to probe in a regime that we are not going to observe stellar binary mass, so binaries, we're not going to be observing only black holes that have stellar masses. We're going to observe massive binary of black holes. They can have considerably more. They can be considerably more massive. So this is just more or less the scenario, the characteristic strain of LISA. These are the ones that we are interested in: 10^7 masses, 10^6 masses, and 10^5. These, in the end, if you see here, what will give on an order unit in frequency is precisely a range that ranges from lens masses from 10^5 to 10^8. So it's a very sweet spot for probing low mass halos, low mass field halos, sub halos, and even galaxies here in this upper region. So this is the shaded region is where wave optics effects will be interested for, will be covered by LISA. So this is more or less here, okay? At the same time, the computation of the amplification factor and also the effect of wave optics is heavily affected by what is the structure and the geometry and the mass profile of our lens. So I just wanted to see, to show that this for in the sense of giving an idea of how detectable is this effect of wave optics, which I call WOF, which is wave optic features. And that are they are precisely always in this regime where W here is order unit, okay? So this is the geometric optics regime, very high frequency, but this is the regime that we are interested in. And if you guys see here, like the blue line corresponds to a profile of normal NFW. The orange one is a singular isothermal sphere. It's characterized only by one parameter, the velocity dispersion that we're going to model the lens with. This is a singular and more cuspy than the NFW case when we move to small radius. And there are other two examples of a lens that is cored. So basically a structure that is that has a core, one with a smaller radii and another one with a bigger radii. And here is the impact of how much of an impact the structure of the lens will have in the amplitude factor, in the amplification factor. These are the modifications in the amplitude of the amplification factor, and this is in the phase, okay? And the detectability of these effects, they are precisely related to not only the height and the lens profile, but also on the impact parameter that we are outputting. Basically, the impact parameter is the distance of the source in the lens plane. So basically, we have the source plane is far away from the lens. The sources can be very far away or close to this to the object that is causing the lens. But basically, if we have this 1.2, and then these are just values that I decided to input here. If we increase the impact parameter, the effect gets smaller. So here it's almost at 60, so 1.6, but now it's at a little bit above 1.20. So the detectability of this wave optic effects, it's not only going to depend on the lens, but also on how far can we go with this impact parameter. Because if we go far enough, then obviously we won't see anything. So but a detectability is just like I was talking in cosmology, it's not only a matter of the lens profile, which I call here lens geometry. It's not only a matter of how matter is distributed there, but also follows a detectability criterion, which this is precisely given by the survey. And in gravitational waves, not only lensing, but any other type of phenomena. If you want to see if you can detect it or not, you use this detectability criterion, which is the mismatch, this curve VM here, which in the sense is just how different two waveforms are from each other. Sorry, there is a chat. Okay. Sorry. But yeah, so how two different waveforms are from each other. And this is actually this y here. The impact parameter is given in units of the Einstein radii. So this is very exciting because normally a small impact parameter is where we have detections. So only we can discriminate between things is when we have a small impact parameter. But these wave optic effects with gravitational wave lensing, we can even go farther beyond. So in this case here, we have assigned a detectability criterion that the mismatch between the two waveforms is when it's bigger than the inverse of the SNR squared, we are going to claim that this is going to be detectable. Of course, that this criteria, it's not arbitrary, but it can vary. Precisely because this is something that you can use on different like scales to meet your detectability criterion or not. But for the purposes of this talk, this is the criteria that we used. And basically, for a lens mass that we have that is 10 to the 6 solar masses, you can see that in this case, we can go to y of almost 15. And after doing this for many lenses and for many, not for many, but for three different source types, you can see that this is the distribution of that impact parameter of how far we can go given one lens geometry, which in this case is the singular isothermosphere. I forgot to put here. But you can see that it can go even to like 70, like critical of 70. So basically, we can go very far away from the source, from the lens, and we can still claim a detection from that. And if you focus here on this is the lens mass, which is the projected virial mass in the lens plane, and this is the virial mass. So this covers and goes to precisely a very interesting regime in the universe, which is rather unexplored if you think in terms of cosmology, because we cannot actually probe these small virial masses using for instance, when we normally probe this small virial mass halos and so on is using strong lensing scenarios, and which are very rare to occur. But with gravitational wave lensing and LISA, for instance, we can probe this window, which is very exciting. And what I have shown so far, and it's something that is coming up recently, this is just an idea of the probability that we can detect these events. So we can how this is the optical depth, so the differential optical depth, how the probability distributes. So the probability will be something for this case of an SAS model will be something related to 10% or something like that. But if we can see the majority of the bigger the probability of being lensed is going to be precisely by host halos that are the dashed lines here that cover 10 to the 7 and even a little bit more, a little bit less, and also subhalos. What the subhalos they do, this is the host halo. The subhalos they just expand and increase by an order of two at least the probability of detecting this wave optics effects. So I try to keep it minimum. I think I went over, and I'm sorry about that. I know that the seminars that go over are terrible, but yeah, with gravitational waves, we can have frequency-dependent lensing effects, which is what we call wave optic features, diffraction, stuff like that. LVK, which is the network LIGO-Virgo-Kagra, is already searching for the case that I began with, which was the strong lensing one, okay, investigating time delay of the same waveforms. But it's limited exploration in these new and exciting avenues like wave optic features and weak lensing. So I have shown by doing a lot of work, but I couldn't show more, that we can actually probe with LISA sources structure and substructure. of our universe with the probabilities being enhanced depending on how we model the lens. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, sorry about this.
Okay, great. All right,
Yeah.
thanks. Here I got thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, so any further quick questions for the speaker? Well, so I can ask something like maybe quick. So you're focusing on these LISA sources, which presumably, I guess, will be things like, emerging supermassive black hole binaries. So the Schwann-Lenzing optical depth, is of order 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. So do we expect to get sufficient numbers of these of these LISA sources to find the occasional strongly lensed merger event?
Yes, so I think that for the case of strongly lensed, yes, we will also have. I think it's going to be shorter, smaller than the weak lens one by a factor of, I don't know, one maybe. I think it's so. For what I can say for sure is that for the 3G network detectors, it's already expected to have 1% of strongly lensed events, so Einstein telescope and so on. And for LISA, this can go a little bit above because we essentially cover more. We are going to even higher redshift. And then, I think from the plots that I've seen, yeah, the SNR was yeah, I think it was a, sorry, did this answer your question?
Well, I mean, like 1% fraction seems surprisingly large to me.
Yeah.
But yeah. Oh, Gil, do you have something to ask?
Yeah, it's just a quick question. So, in the difference between waveforms, is this only using the frequency information, or are you also using the enhancement in the amplitude?
Yes. So, actually, we use the information of everything. So not only the amplitude, we also get from the frequency. So the phase difference as well. So, yeah, I don't know if I removed this, but basically we get everything. So everything that we have from the frequency, we just go to time domain and where everything is going to be scrambled.
Okay,
So we cannot actually.
but you don't actually know the intrinsic amplitude, right?
No. So
So
the
do you
intrinsic amplitude.
marginalize over that?
Yes. So the intrinsic amplitude will be related to the magnification, and yes, okay. Yes, we can, and we normally so the per so the PE part of the project we're still ongoing because we have to validate with another pipeline. But let me see. Yes, I think we can marginalize over it, and just to focus on the difference in the phase. Yeah, this is what you're saying.
Yeah, it seems like that might reduce the detectability a little bit if you don't know the
Yeah.
intrinsic amplitude and can only use the frequency dependence and phase shifts.
Yes. But okay. So now I see what you're saying. So yeah, so we are already removing the part that it's coming from the magnification because we precisely don't know.
Okay,
This,
good.
yeah,
It's
the
perfect.
strong lensing part is going to be the magnification is going to be right here, more or less, which is something related to Neil's question. So over here it's already out. And whenever we have this criterion of impact parameter, whenever the impact parameter is below one, we already remove it because it's going to be strong lensing. Yeah. Okay, thank you for the
Okay,
question.
thanks.
Okay, so since we're like 10, 11 minutes past, so why don't we stop here? So thanks again, Guy. And thanks everyone else for coming.